Welcome to Ariel Investments Conversation Series for Black History Month. I'm Arielle Patrick, Chief Communications Officer of Ariel. As the first Black-owned investment firm in the United States, we have seen overwhelming evidence that diverse leadership, workforces, and supply chains drive better outcomes for all stakeholders. It also drives better outcomes for shareholders like us. It's no secret that the past 2 years have challenged us as a society. The Black Lives Matter movement reignited a centuries-old dialogue around racial inequality and highlighted the need for urgent action. The COVID-19 pandemic continues to remind us of the fragility of balance sheets and the vulnerability of our communities, especially those of people of color. However, many of today's societal challenges are economic. Now more than ever, the private sector can take a leading role in addressing social issues. 21st century corporate management teams must think holistically about designing their operating environments around diversity, equity, and inclusion to drive change across the globe. To be successful, however, they must also measure it. What gets measured gets done. So how do we measure success? At Ariel, it's with what we call the three P's: people, purchasing, and philanthropy. Each week, we will focus on one of these themes to bring calls to action for diversity, equity, and inclusion to corporations and shareholders alike. These insights will be delivered by legends in these industries. This week, I'm joined by Salesforce Chief Procurement Officer Craig Cuffey, Billion Dollar Roundtable Chairman Shelley Stewart, and Ariel Alternatives Chairman Les Brunn to talk about purchasing. Craig, Shelley, and Les, thank you so much for joining us for Ariel's Black History Month conversation series. I wanted to start out by asking you all to introduce yourselves, what your day job looks like, and name a figure in Black history who has been most influential to you. So I'm going to start with our very own Les Brunn, who is chairman of Ariel Alternatives, the private equity subsidiary focused on closing the racial wealth gap.
Thanks, Ariel. Great to be with Shelley and Craig for this conversation. So my day job, as you've asked for, is as chairman and chief executive officer of Ariel Alternatives. It is the alternative asset subsidiary of Ariel Investments, and its first initiative, of course, is Project Black, which is intended to invest in mid-market companies that can serve as tier one suppliers to the Fortune 500. And we're off to an exciting and quick start and are delighted about our progress. As to a figure in Black history, let me make this very personal, and it happens to be my maternal grandfather, who was a pharmacist in Haiti and who was a man of extraordinary grace and exceptional kindness, and who lived as elegant a life for a middle-income fellow with a high sense of integrity that served as a role model for me and has continued to this day to be someone who I think about often and dream about often.
That's fantastic. And as a fellow Haitian immigrant, I am so touched. Shelley, how about you?
Yeah, thank you, Ariel. It's great to be here with Les and Craig. And I don't actually have a day job anymore. I retired from DuPont about 3 years ago as the chief procurement officer there, and I had that role in three other corporations, and then I worked almost 20 years for United Technologies in a number of roles, and I left there when I was head of worldwide sourcing. So I'm basically a supply chain individual most of my career, and I'm pretty busy in retirement. I sit on two public company boards and do some advisory work as well. So I'm really excited to be here today. And if I think about role models, there are a lot in my life, but I'll point to the most influential one, which was my father, who Craig knew very well, Shelley Stewart. The reason he was my role model is not just because he was my dad, but because he cared about everyone. And the example I'll give you is I integrated a public school system on Long Island and watched my father get carried off to jail every day so that I could go to that school. And he didn't do it just for me, but he did it for the other students that were there that looked like me. And we were ultimately successful. and he didn't lose his job. And it made me feel like the commitment that he showed was real, and I needed to have a similar commitment, which I've tried to do throughout my life.
That's fantastic. We're also joined by Craig Cuffey from Salesforce. So excited to hear your day job and influences.
Well, you know, Shelley Stewart would tell you that my day job is chasing parts, that he and I were doing that back in the late 80s and early 90s for a long time. So I'm Craig Cuffey. Thanks for having me here. I'm the Executive Vice President and Chief Procurement Officer for a little company called Salesforce based in San Francisco, as well as running, you know, managing global sourcing and spend for them. I sit on the boards of NMSDC, the National Minority Supplier Development Council, which is a great honor, as well as the board of NPower, which is a New York-based nonprofit that focuses on helping underrepresented minorities and young veterans get careers in tech. So that's great work. And about 6 months ago, I went on a public company board, Franklin Covey, one of the leaders in executive leadership and training. So I'm having lots of fun and looking forward to one day being Shelley, you know, in my retirement. When I think about role models, you know, there are lots of role models. There are lots of folks that influence us and our lives and how we operate. But one who died very, very young is my brother Lionel. Lionel Cuffey died in the middle 80s of complications of HIV when we didn't know what HIV was. But in his short 36 years, he made a significant impact. To this day, there is an award in his honor that Rutgers University awards to the LGBT community. And back in the late 60s, early 70s, he was out loud and proud and marching long before any of this was popular. And so it's part of his legacy, right? When we think about diversity and inclusion and what it really means to include folks who operate, who look, who play differently from us, it's really important. So I keep that alive.
That's beautiful. So let's dive into our tagline of the decade, DEI. So when most people think about diversity, equity, and inclusion, particularly in the corporate arena, they just think about the people vertical, right? So diverse workforces, equity in leadership opportunities from the entry level to the boardroom. But a really critical way in which companies can live their values is through this thing called business diversity, formerly called supply chain diversity. I think it's evolved a bit more to be called business diversity more holistically. And Les, you know, when you led the charge and launched Project Black, one of the things you identified was the $1 trillion opportunity. I was hoping if you could identify what the $1 trillion opportunity is, and then I'll have Craig and Shelley talk us through how they, from their seats, participate in helping Fortune 500 companies get there.
Sure. Thanks, Ariel. The $1 trillion opportunity is fairly straightforward. Fortune 500s have spent, on average, about 2% of their total spend with minority-owned companies. That's about $125 billion. In the wake of the murder of George Floyd and the pressure that was put upon that constituency, that community, by all of their stakeholders to increase their activities with minority-owned companies, they've all expressed, for the most part, a desire to expand that level of spend from the 2% that it represents today to roughly anywhere between 10 to 15%, and for public utilities, even higher than that. If you do the math, it's pretty straightforward. That translates into about $1 billion of opportunity for minority-owned companies, diverse companies. We think that there is a way to look at this that broadens the aperture and takes away from the rather parochial and provincial view of minority-owned companies as only those which are small and serving commodity-like markets, and really broaden that out into the tech value-added marketplace, which is where Project Black is intending to play.
So, Shelley, Craig, why is this hard, right? Why is it difficult? What are the hindrances to getting there as it relates to this goal of a certain percentage in
minority-owned businesses in your supply chain? And also, is there a magic number where we can pat ourselves on the back and say, we did it?
Yeah, let me take a shot. First of all, I didn't say that I chair the billion-dollar roundtable, which gives me an opportunity to talk about this subject often. And it's the 28 companies in this country that spend over $1 billion with minority women-owned LGBT and veteran businesses. So I have a perspective that some people actually can get it done. Having worked in corporate America all my career, it tends to be difficult because there are not one, a significant number of large suppliers. So you have to do it with numbers of smaller suppliers. So one of the important things that Les talks about is making sure that we create large-scale black and brown suppliers. That will help the problem. The other piece of it is, and I think Les pointed out, the whole George Floyd incident ignited corporate America's thought processes around this. You find that many corporations have set significantly higher goals and targets than they've ever had before, not just from the chief procurement officer or the supplier diversity leader, but from the CEO of the company. And the truth of the matter, that's where it has to start. Because you can do it with a lot of small suppliers if you have to, right? And right now, there are only a handful of 500 million to $1 billion black businesses, right? And the question for all of us is, how do we grow these businesses to make them scalable? So, Ariel, I'll tell you, there's all kinds of excuses of why you can't do it. But the truth of the matter is, if you set the targets, create the objectives, put it into people's performance pay, people will get it done, right? And it hasn't been that high on the agendas of corporate America. And I won't say everyone, because there are corporations that are really trying hard, and some of them are really succeeding. But it takes true leadership to make it happen.
So basically what you're saying is what gets measured gets done. There needs to be accountability. There need to be metrics, the same way you would approach any other business strategy. Craig, what does that look like for you? Tell us a little bit about the war stories now that you're still in the seat. You know, I know Shelley is enjoying retirement, but still fighting the fight. Would love to hear your perspectives on the pain points there.
Yeah, still as a practitioner. Shelley's still a practitioner. He just doesn't admit it. You know, it's from Les and Shelley, it's about scale, right? It's really about scale. And so I know, when we think about Project Black, what we're talking about is businesses of scale. How do we create businesses of scale that are owned and run, right, by black and brown people? You have to build them. To Shelley's point, this is a management imperative like any other. You have a growth imperative, you have a margin imperative, you pick a number. Companies measure numbers. They look at numbers. They talk about numbers. Every staff meeting at ELT, we talk about the numbers. So you can't run from them. And it has to be, as the accountants would say, what's the tone at the top, right? And Shelley talked about that. What's the tone at the top? The tone at the top has to be, we will create an ecosystem, right? It's not all in the back of the chief procurement officer, right? It's an ecosystem of which the chief procurement officer is a significant part of, key influencer, key executioner, but an ecosystem that embraces the absolute thought of driving business, more business, and helping creating business with a diverse set of suppliers. Talk about focus, right? We have increased within Salesforce our focus since I joined the company about 5 years ago, and since the killing, the murder, let's call it what it was, the legal term is murder, the murdering of George Floyd. I mean, it's hundreds of percent, right? If I look at what I spent on diverse suppliers 3 years ago and what I spend with diverse suppliers now, It is turning over every rock. And to Les's point, it's not commodities. It's not janitorial services. It's not food service. It's businesses that are at the core of what your business does. Shelley and I talked about this a few weeks ago. We had a CPO forum with just a handful of CPOs. I have thousands upon thousands of engineers, right? So I'm out looking for, always looking for talent, but specifically minority-owned engineering firms at scale that employ folks right out of college, right? Because they're out there. They're not just at, the named engineering schools, but they're out there and getting them into the fold, into the franchise. Legal services, investment services like Ariel Capital, where we are a customer and they are a customer of ours, where tell me why not? As Robin Washington says, I know there have to be black bankers out there. So I want to see some diversity when people come in and ask us for money on things. So you have to kind of demand it, right, and have a well-formed point of view. But it's about building, to me, the ecosystem with a tone at the top, right, because it just doesn't happen by itself.
So you're talking also about, so when we talk supply chain, I guess in the old moniker, it was often, misconstrued as things like, catering, janitorial services, et cetera. But what you're talking about are also high margin businesses like legal services, advertising, mm-hmm. right? The whole ecosystem that supports a business. So what would you say to a chief procurement officer who might say, well, listen, I want the best law firm in the business and Skadden's my team on this legal issue, right? What should in-house teams be demanding from even majority-owned firms? And how do you go about that conversation to ensure that the client service team is also diverse? And also, I guess the other question is that enough? Open-ended, but I'm curious about what Shelley and Craig, both of you think there, and Les, I'm sure, having worked on many parts of the business world, you have thoughts as well.
Just to take a stab at it, and there are two things I would say. One is that you're asking the right question, which is to think about this not as supply chain, but rather as spend that companies make in order to maintain the infrastructure to produce whatever it is that they produce by way of product and service. So if you break it down into its component pieces, there is the direct piece, which is the supply chain piece, and then the indirect piece, which is how do you keep the lights on, and who does everything else for the enterprise to make sure that it's able to actually produce and market the products and services that it produces. Those are two distinctly different buckets, and we can operate in both of those buckets. There are certain buckets where there is a propensity to select the biggest and the best on the belief in the old days of you can't go wrong buying IBM. And so it may be the largest law firm, which is predominantly white. But within each of those firms, as John Rogers likes to say, you gotta live the values. Within all of those firms, there are those pockets of folks who look like us, who come from our communities, that we can insist be part of the delivery mechanisms for those products and services that we're purchasing. And in most instances where we can, we try to provide it so that those are the folks who are viewed as the introducer of the business opportunity, so that they get the credit that rainmakers typically tend to get in all areas of business and commerce.
So Ariel, a little bit of this has to do with the role of the chief procurement officers and how it has evolved. I know John, I've always been in the audience when John talks about business diversity, and I always feel like he's looking at me, right? Because I've been working this has been a part of my larger role for most of my career. And the truth of the matter is, chief procurement officers didn't influence all the dollars, as Les talks about. Direct and indirect, a lot of the indirect space, marketing, legal, insurance, those things were outside the purview of the chief procurement officer for a long time. But as our roles have evolved and the discussion around business diversity has grown, we've been able to influence the outcomes and the decisions made. And I will tell you, that's probably just happened in the last 10 years, right? And Craig can validate that from from his perspective. But I would also say it's the CPO's job when that supplier is sitting across from him to say, if I hire you, I want to make sure there's some people in here that look like our customers. And there's nothing wrong. And by the way, I have said it before. I have actually said it to suppliers that were doing business with my company. I said, no one looks like me that works on this job. And but you'd be surprised how much influence that has with who comes in the door the next day and who they're hiring and where they're recruiting. That is the role of the chief procurement officer as it has evolved in corporate America today.
It's a lot of tone setting, right? And when you say set the tone, you're setting expectations, right? You get really clear, right? When I say set the tone, I'm setting expectations. And if you don't ask, or in this case, tell, as Shelley said, right? But effectively, don't come back, right? And they better be an integral part of the deal, not just the guy you found who was in the office, right? And you put in front of me, which has happened 1,000 times to all of us, but someone who I'm going to engage with and work with, right? And help make him or her and your company successful. That's really important. And Shelley's absolutely right. There's a whole bunch of spend, right, that we would typically call non-addressable spend because it happened automatically, right? So if you're doing an M&A, there are a handful of companies on the planet that you go to help you with the integration, right? Working on that. If you do, you know, banking, working on that. You do retirement planning, 401k, working on that, right? And we have sort of one of the best in the business represented on the call. So on and so on. So you have to, as a CPO, lean into this. And someone's going to tell you, why not? Well, haven't we looked here? It is the same, in my mind, the same process I use when I'm hiring people, right? I want a diverse slate. Because if you get that diverse slate, right, you may not have Skadden, whatever they are. I can't remember all 12 names of these firms. There will be a person of color in that firm that one day will step out of that firm, right, and create their own firm. And guess what? We're there to help, right? We're there to help grow, right, that black and brown firm over time. That's how this is going to happen. Because if you're good enough,
that's really smart,
right? If you're good enough to get in one of those top firms, you're kind of good enough to run your own firm.
That's great. So basically, by grooming more John Rogers within, say, a bulge bracket bank ecosystem, you're making it possible for another Ariel to exist later on in their career. That's really interesting. So who else besides the chief procurement officer needs to drive outcomes? So we're looking at shareholders, the board, other levels throughout the organization. How do you, as the CPO, make sure you're not standing alone? And who do you need to really bring along with you to drive these outcomes? If the answer may be everyone, but I'd just love to know where you see the most critical opportunity and where those folks that, you know, in the ecosystem can really get more involved. So it's not just on one figure in the management team.
So taking a stab at this, before starting Ariel Alternatives, I spent most of my time in corporate boardrooms, fortunately enough, in positions of leadership. And it really does start in the boardroom, and it goes to the point that Craig was making, which is tone at the top. Right? There has to be an attenuation and a desire to achieve an outcome. There's got to be intentionality behind it in terms of driving to that outcome. And the way you drive to that outcome is you incent the performance, the behavior that leads to that outcome. And so the chief procurement officer is a critical part of this. And I'm fortunate enough to have two of the best on the phone with me today. They are part of an ecosystem that is increasingly concerned about this outcome, but they're not able to act unilaterally, but there is support, greater levels of support coming from other areas of the organization, particularly from the boardroom and the balance of the C-suite, who understand that this is a matter of top importance to their stakeholders and other constituents, if no one else.
2 points, Ariel, on that. One, as a follow-on to Les, the boardroom is important. And I was actually on a board call today, and in the deck was a 20% commitment to supplier diversity or business diversity. That was in the deck, right? And I duly noted it as well. The second piece of it is, if I look at the 28 companies that are billion-dollar roundtable members, when we have an annual event, their CEOs want to show up, right? That's where it that's how important it is. So in the companies that get it right, it's not just the CPO, it's the CEO, the CFO. They have a lot of sway in decisions on what services get bought. So there are models out there for people to look at around who does it well, right? And I suggest that it isn't just the 28 companies in the billion-dollar roundtable that do it well, but they're really good at what they do.
That's fantastic. What would you say, I've heard often in conversations with people on this topic, particularly in the asset management space, that it's hard to break pre-existing mandates or contracts or relationships. So say you've had a long-standing relationship with the same, you know, 401k provider, and God knows who is best friends with or golfs with that, you know, owner of that business. How do you go about essentially pursuing the RFP process and using diversity as the catalyst without, stepping on toes, ruffling feathers, making people feel that it's an either or instead of a both and? And then the other question is, if it's not about replacing pre-existing mandates, how can you get creative about creating new opportunities with new vendor relationships where perhaps there isn't a vendor, or where perhaps you could add an additional vendor? I just would love to understand that tension, because I'm sure that's very difficult politically throughout the organization.
You know, you would not go, and Shelley, jump in anytime, you would not go and tear apart a longstanding relationship and say it's because I'm looking for a diverse supplier. That will not help you win friends and influence people. There is a natural break in most relationships at the end of a contract period. Now, we like, depending on the commodity, 3 years, 5 years, depending on what we're buying. And a year before any of those big enterprise contracts, we'll start talking about, okay, what are we going to do next, right? And that's the time for the CPO, along with others, to say, we want to make sure, just like when we're hiring talent, we have a diverse slate. Who's out there, right? Not a scramble at the end, but who's out there? And be very clear about your bias is to bring in a diverse supplier. But you want to have a robust competition. And a diverse supplier may not be, at the end of the day, the one that wins on all points. And so that's a whole different discussion. But the fact that you get them in play in places where they weren't before is, you know, let's be clear. There's nothing like winning, but that is really important in the discovery process. And there may be an opportunity, right? You may make the decision, you know what? I'm going to break this business up. Let's call it a $100 million award. We're going to give you $20 million of it. And I'll manage two suppliers, right? Not our preference, depending on the commodity. But in many cases, it makes complete sense to do that, right?
Yeah, Craig makes a really important point, and that is that we suppose that the world has always been comprised of large giants and small fish. Every one of those large enterprises started with nothing at one point and got to where they are because they produced a better product, had better customer relations, whatever it was that got them to where they are. And I think the opportunity to do that is what's important to provide to the firms that are out there that aren't necessarily the brand names or the top three in any particular category.
Hey, Ariel, I felt it was always my job to go force it my way into a room on this topic in the company that I was in to talk about changing suppliers and bringing in diverse suppliers. I have to tell you, I didn't always wait for the contract to end. But my question was, we're spending millions of dollars in this space, and I know there are two Black and brown suppliers out here, and they're not getting any of this business. So if you have these jobs like Craig has, And like I had, if you're not breaking glass every once in a while, you know, and you'd be surprised how people react, right? Because they don't always say, well, we want to leave it status quo. Sometimes they say, well, tell us more. Why are you picking this supplier? Why are you suggesting it, right? And by the way, they have to win the business. It's not like you're giving it to them, right? They have to win the business. All you're doing is providing the introduction, which they wouldn't necessarily get if you weren't there.
You know, and in Shelley's done what I've done, we literally as CPOs sponsor suppliers, right? And what that means is we'll make a warm introduction. We will sit in the meeting with the business unit owner, whoever, the CFO, and we will make sure that the doors are open. But you have to walk in, right? You have to walk in and you got to have on your best Sunday suit. And oh, by the way, at scale, you've got to deliver. So we get back to where we started, building businesses of scale with great leadership, great execution engines inside of them, great operators is what wins every single time.
In the words of Shelley and Craig, break some glass, be brave. I love it. So we're going to do a quick round robin to close out. We so appreciate your time. Is there an example of a minority-owned business that you've brought in, whether in your position as a board member at a company or in the CPO office, that you've just been really proud to help succeed? And just more broadly, any favorite Black or Latinx-owned businesses that you'd like to shout out? Shelley, how about you?
Yeah, I have one that... it's WestNet, and it's a minority lab supply company who I helped with great strategy, team with a big lab supply company, and win some business at DuPont. And they took that model and they extrapolated and did work at Merck. They do work at a bunch of other companies as a result. And by the way, it wasn't easy. It was me forcing people to listen and look at their value proposition with Thermo Fisher together. And it's really proven to be a successful value prop. And I really feel good about Gordon and that whole team at WestNet.
WestNet, ladies and gentlemen. Awesome. What about you, Craig?
I'm for a bunch of reasons you'll understand, I'm not going to say the names, but I'll tell the stories. Okay. Because they'll all come after me in that space. All the competitors will come after me. But we have a number of minority-owned, value-added resellers that help us manage our business globally. And one in particular, based outside of this country, who I'm like, who are these people? What are they doing? What are we talking about? What more proliferation are we creating? Knocked it out of the park. Have gotten more business out of us. And continue to be a mainstay in the space that they play for us on the technology side. I will shout out, I will use this name, a perennial favorite who's hitting out of the park for us, WWT. And we recently, and I mean in the last couple of years, began an engagement with them. And it's really funny, Dave and I have kind of known about each other for a long time, but we never did any business together, right? So we brought them in, and they have a big chunk of our business on that side of the house as well. So they're out there if you're looking and if you embrace them, right? And, you know, I'm really, really proud to say that we have hundreds of percent improvement, right, in that space. I want to say one more thing, and this goes back to on another topic, an early topic I didn't get it in there. A retired CFO that I grew up with, like a childhood friend, whose company struggled with DEI for a long time. And the CEO said, I'm done with this. This is a Baltimore-based company, 100 plus years old. He says, I'm done with this. And he went to his board and said, this is what I'm going to do, right? And he calls it the three M's: measures, management, and money. So tying that incentive, right? Creating a set of measures, rigorously managing them, and then rewarding them. And I think you take that very simple philosophy from the CEO on down, right? Businesses improve. That simple. This is not some social issue. This is a business problem and a business imperative that business people will fix.
The 3 M's is a perfect place to end. Thank you all, Les Brunn, Aerial Alternatives, Craig Cuffey, Salesforce, Shelley Stewart, Billion Dollar Roundtable. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to our conversation series for Black History Month. And check us out every week this month or visit our website, aerialinvestments.com, AREIEL investments.com.